Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Impeachment.
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 Impeachment investigation.
A growing number of Democrats say it's time to impeach President Trump.
There are clear threats in what has been done or what has been reported to our national security, and we must follow the facts and hold the president accountable.
He's basically saying to us, you're darn right I'm colluding, and what are you going to do about it?
I'm Matt Katz, and today on The Takeaway for September 24th, why reports that the president withheld aid to Ukraine for political leverage are uniting Democrats against the Trump administration. Plus, how do we cover the victims of an alleged sexual abuse case, a case like football player Antonio Brown's? We'll talk about that with Jane McManus from the New York Daily News. Also on the show, how librarians across the country are tackling the great digital divide in rural and urban communities.
I had a gentleman, all he wanted to do was watch YouTube videos of tractor engines running. He found the tractor engine community on YouTube, and now he's an internet person.
All that coming up. Let's start with impeachment talk.
It doesn't matter what I discuss, but I will say this. Somebody ought to look into Joe Biden's statement because it was disgraceful.
It does seem like the dam is breaking on the Democratic side. Just last night, 10 Democrats all announced that if the new allegations are true, that they would then be open to impeachment proceedings.
There was no quid pro quo.
Did you ask the Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden?
No, actually I didn't.
You did ask Ukraine to look into Joe Biden?
Of course I did.
Nancy Pelosi already under growing pressure to move forward with impeachment. She is now issuing an ultimatum to the Trump White House.
I do hope that if Vice President Biden engaged in behavior that was inappropriate, I do hope that we get to the bottom of that.
If these allegations are true, it's a clear abuse of the president's office.
It is time for us to call out this illegal behavior and start impeachment proceedings right now.
Great conversation, totally appropriate conversation, couldn't have been better.
On Monday at the UN General Assembly in New York, President Trump responded to allegations that he attempted to pressure the president of Ukraine to open a corruption investigation into former Vice President Joe Biden by withholding military aid to the country.
We had a perfect phone call with the president of Ukraine. Everybody knows it. It's just a Democrat witch hunt. Here we go again.
And last night, there was another breaking development in the Ukraine story when the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal all reported that President Trump had personally ordered nearly $400 million in military aid to be withheld less than a week before his July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky. Following the release of the Mueller report in April, House Democrats have been deeply divided over whether or not to move towards impeaching the president. But by Monday night, things seem to have changed. A group of freshman Democrats who had previously resisted backing impeachment wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post in response to the latest allegations against President Trump. Together, they wrote, "If these allegations are true, we believe these actions represent an impeachable offense." I'm joined by two Democratic lawmakers, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell. She represents Michigan's 12th District in the House of Representatives. Congresswoman, welcome.
Good to be here.
And Congressman Tom Malinowski, who represents New Jersey's 7th. Congressman, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much.
Representative Dingell, I wanted to start with you. Last night, you tweeted that you are in support of an impeachment inquiry, something you had previously not been willing to back. So tell us what changed your mind.
You know, I'm very worried about how divided this country is, and I continue to be worried. And if you read the Mueller report, very few people talk about how he talked about how Russia was trying to divide us as a country. But we cannot be divided on the rule of law. And the revelations that have occurred in the last week, our fundamental responsibility as members of Congress is to protect our national security and to protect our Constitution. And there are clear threats in what has been done or what has been reported to our national security. And we must follow the facts and hold the president accountable.
Many in your caucus had wanted to go for impeachment after reading the Mueller report, which you had just referenced. Did something in this whistleblower complaint raise the stakes for you? Something different than what you had previously understood about how this administration was acting?
You know, I have sort of an interesting perspective. When I was in high school, I interned and was very lucky to be close to a Republican Senator, Bob Griffin, who at the time was in leadership. And I was with him the day, and he talked to me about ethics and about what your moral responsibility is as a legislator on the day that he came out after the Watergate tapes had been made public and said this president lied. And he went to the White House and told Richard Nixon he needed to resign. 17 days later, Richard Nixon did resign. This president took money that had been appropriated by the Congress for, it's been reported, we need the facts, but was appropriated by the Congress for national security to protect us from foreign enemies. It subject it to, quite frankly, it almost sounds like blackmail, and is using it for his own personal gain. That's just a threat to our national security, and it's a threat to our Constitution.
Representative Malinowski, now you've been supporting impeachment since early in the summer. Does this Ukraine story represent a watershed moment for you?
Yes, it does. I think President Trump has done a lot of things that are arguably impeachable, but this is a new level of disdain for the rule of law. You know, his defenders after the Mueller report said that, yeah, Russia may have interfered in our election in 2016, but Trump had nothing to do with it. There was no collusion. And now he's basically saying to us, you're darn right I'm colluding, and what are you going to do about it? He's, as Congresswoman Dingell said, he's extorting, using U.S. assistance to extort a foreign government into helping him in the next election. He's basing our foreign policy on whether foreign governments are willing to do him political favors. We cannot have that. And I'm afraid that in our system, as terrible as impeachment is as a last resort, only the House of Representatives has the constitutional authority to deal with a problem like this.
And now, Congressman, there are seven freshman lawmakers who wrote an op-ed in The Washington Post calling these allegations impeachable offenses, which you agree with, and you're also a freshman lawmaker. How significant is it that these fellow freshman lawmakers are now coming out in favor of impeachment?
I think it's very significant. First of all, a number of us, including the lawmakers who wrote that op-ed, have a foreign policy or national security background. We're all people who've taken the oath to protect the Constitution and our country many times before. We don't come to this decision lightly. But when the rule of law is in the balance, when the national security of our country is in the balance, we feel we have to do what we think is right. And I think the path forward now is quite clear for House Democrats and I think Republicans who care about the security of our country are going to have a very difficult personal choice to make.
Representative Dingell, the Washington Post reported last night that Nancy Pelosi is gauging her caucus about whether or not we've reached a tipping point toward impeachment. There's apparently going to be a meeting today. Do you have any sense of how that meeting with the Democratic caucus is going to play out? Do you think that the caucus is going to agree that we have reached a tipping point?
So, first of all, I have not spoken to the speaker on this in the last few days, but I've talked to a number of my colleagues, and I think we're all, you know, all of us have different perspectives, all of us are concerned about what's happening in the country. But probably talked to his 30 or so colleagues over the weekend. They are concerned. This is a whistleblower case that the inspector general said needed to be brought to the attention of Congress because it is a threat to our national security. This administration blocked bringing that threat, which they are required to do, and releasing it or giving it to the Intelligence Committee. We're all greatly disturbed, and how we proceed bothers us, but we have no choice. And, you know, Republicans should not be dividing us on following the rule of the law. We all have that same fundamental responsibility. So we do have a caucus today. We'll see what's said. But I think you're going to find that we're all trying to be thoughtful, measured, appropriate, get the facts, have the facts, and then do what our moral obligation is as representatives to protect this country.
Now, Congresswoman, I'm going to get into the weeds for a moment here, but to see if there are other potential options beyond impeachment. In the past week, we've heard about other possible ways to put pressure on Trump, like reviving the inherent contempt powers, which would allow you to jail or fine uncooperative members of the executive branch. Are there discussions about other non-impeachment possibilities here that could similarly bring justice to this matter?
I think what we're trying to do is to get the facts. That's what's very disturbing. You know, we're talking to you, quite frankly, on newspaper reports of what has been in there, apparently collaborated by several different people. But this administration tries to evade having to answer questions by simply refusing to appear or to answer the questions. So we all believe in due process. We need the facts. If people refuse to cooperate and give us the facts, we need to look at what all the tools are.
Congressman, what happens if this goes forward, you impeach, and it's ultimately stonewalled by a Republican Senate, which frankly feels like an inevitability? If the Republicans don't vote to convict in the Senate and they don't vote to remove President Trump from office, is impeachment a waste of time and a political liability for Democrats going forward?
No and no. First of all, I don't think we know what's going to happen in the Senate. This is a new situation. We already saw Senator Romney come out with a very strong statement making clear that the facts need to come out and that if they are what they seem to be, it's a very, very bad situation for the president. We have a number of Republican senators who will be facing the voters next year in very difficult elections for them. I don't know if it's in their interest to try to justify the president's conduct in such an egregious case. But setting that aside, there's something so much larger at stake. We're a country based on laws. And if a law is repeatedly violated and we do nothing about it, it's almost as if that law no longer exists. The lines that the president is crossing will just be erased, not by his bad actions, but by our hesitation to call those actions for what they are. And so for me, the obligation that we face is very, very clear. We have to defend these lines or they will disappear. We can kick President Trump out of office in the next election, but if we don't hold him accountable now, we will live in a country where presidents henceforth will be able to do whatever they want so long as they can continue to win elections. We will be an electoral popular democracy, not a constitutional democracy. I cannot accept that.
Congresswoman Dingell, do you have any faith that if you were to find that the president committed crimes here via an impeachment, that the Republicans in the Senate would vote to convict?
I think we have to take this day by day. I don't think we should be divided as a Congress on following the rule of the law. We need to see what the facts are. We need to see what the investigation brings out. And I hope that my colleagues on both sides will very closely study the facts and see where they take us. I am very worried about an impeachment dividing this country further. In my lifetime, I've never seen it so divided. But I think all of us, Republican or Democrats, we're Americans first. And we have a moral responsibility to protect our national security and to protect our Constitution. And as Tom said so well, that we are a nation of laws. So am I worried about what we're going to see? But I was there. I watched when a Republican senator in leadership called for Richard Nixon to resign when they had the facts that he had lied on tape. And I'm going to choose to believe that my colleagues, when they get the facts, and when we all get the facts, we'll know what the right thing to do is.
And Congressman Malinowski, one final question for you, if I could. You won a tight race against incumbent Republican Letterman Lance in New Jersey. And so this is a political question, if I could. Do you get the sense that independent and maybe more right-leaning voters in your district will support you if the House goes forward with impeachment? Or do you understand that that could be a political liability?
The voters who sent me to Washington first and foremost want me to fight for their interests. And in New Jersey, that's about taxes and transportation and health care. So long as I keep doing that, then they are going to be okay with me doing what I believe is right to protect the Constitution of the United States and to protect our national security. I came out for an impeachment inquiry a couple of months ago, and the reaction I've gotten back home in my district has been very, very positive. And again, I think especially in the face of the news of the last week, I'm not worried about the consequences of doing the right thing.
Congresswoman Debbie Dingell represents Michigan's 12th District in the House of Representatives, and Congressman Tom Malinowski represents New Jersey's 7th. Thank you to you both. Much appreciated for coming on The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Last week, football player Antonio Brown was released by the New England Patriots amid ongoing investigations into allegations of sexual assault. This came only a day after Nike dropped their sponsorship of the star wide receiver. Nike dropped the sponsorship after text messages were published by Sports Illustrated showing Brown allegedly threatening a woman who said she was sexually harassed by Brown. This seems to be a shift for Nike, since other athletes like Kobe Bryant and Cristiano Ronaldo continue to reap profits from their company sponsorships, even though they've also been accused of sexual assault. Joining me now is Jane McManus, sports columnist for the New York Daily News and the director of the Marist College Center for Sports Communication. Jane, thank you so much for coming back on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So catch us up. What was in the text messages allegedly sent by Antonio Brown that Sports Illustrated published last week?
Antonio Brown sent some texts that were attributed to him to a woman who'd served as a kind of contractor for some home improvement. She was a muralist painting in his home. And he accused her after she did this in this series of text messages. It was a group text that included his attorney of basically trying to extort him. He also included photos of her children and said she was broke and the league should look into how little money she had. And all of it was very intimidating, harassing. You know, this was a situation that people around Brown could have very easily handled. There was no need for him to reach out personally to harass this person. And I think that ultimately was something that the Patriots decided meant that he was not going to get in line and how, you know, they expected him to conduct himself off of the field.
And same with Nike. Is that why Nike ultimately decided to drop Antonio Brown as well?
Well, I think if you look at the history of players who cross lines in professional sports and get in trouble with both their teams and their advertisers, usually there's some piece of information that comes out, whether it's a video or a text or a conversation, something that people can see that's unfettered by an idea of an allegation, right? It's not just a court document with charges in it. And that is ultimately what makes a difference, because that's something that you have a gut reaction to. Whether you're just a fan, whether you're a team owner, or whether you are someone cutting checks for an athlete.
What is the responsibility of companies who sponsor athletes when they're accused of sexual assault or harassment? I mean, in this case, like you said, there were these text messages that came out. But in general, what is their responsibility when they see their players get accused of something like this?
Generally now, when we look at athletes and we see the position that they're placed in, we expect more from them. Their leagues expect more from them, which is why there are conduct clauses in these contracts that they're signing. Same is true with the endorsement deals that they sign. They're representing a company. You are no longer, when you're being paid that kind of money, just working for yourself. And I think that we've come to understand when we have kids in the stands cheering people on, I think we expect a little bit more from them.
When it comes to Nike right now, they're sponsoring women athletes, disabled athletes, Colin Kaepernick. Does that show us a political shift for the company?
Nike's never just been about selling shoes. You know, as somebody who loves women's sports and who follows the athletes who play, I've always been interested in the aspirational and inspirational ads. Now, it's very much about moving forward as a gender. And so I think when you have athletes that you're signing, like Kaepernick is obviously, you're not signing Colin Kaepernick, who's not playing in the NFL right now, because you want him to sell shoes on Sundays. Mm-hmm. He's not out there to do that. He's selling an idea of standing for something larger than yourself. And I think when they put together athletes, and if you looked at the list of athletes that they have, you can see that it's a strategy about representation and it's a strategy about aspiration.
We're talking about allegations of sexual assault and harassment against NFL wide receiver Antonio Brown, and we're going to shift the focus now to survivors of this type of abuse. On 60 Minutes this past Sunday night, Chanel Miller spoke up about the media's treatment of her versus that of her abuser, Brock Turner. In 2016, Turner was given a very lenient sentence for sexually assaulting Miller, but much of the coverage focused more on Turner's side of the story.
Did you feel that that description of him as a championship swimmer sort of changed the narrative?
Yes. They were framing it like he had so much to lose and were not focusing on what had already been lost for me.
With this in mind, we're going to now continue with Jane McManus from the New York Daily News. Jane, what do we know about the women who were allegedly assaulted and harassed by Antonio Brown?
There are two of them in particular, and we know something about them because one has come forward and filed a civil suit. That was a very powerful soundbite, and I think that shows it's really up to them how much they want to come forward and how much they want to speak publicly. Women who make these accusations oftentimes become doubly victimized. And so I think sometimes when you're a member of the media, you want to reach out and you want to make sure that you're trying to get their side of the story, but only insofar as they want to come forward.
How do we keep in mind the fact that there are survivors here and not just players who might lose a contract or lose a deal with a team?
I think it's really important to have thought about these issues before you start covering a story like this. You have to make sure that when Antonio Brown's texts are insinuating that someone is out to get him for his money, that you're not making that same assumption. And you have to make sure that when you listen to that, you're listening to a dynamic that builds up around teams in these situations where people often rush to reflexively defend someone, even though they don't know the facts in the case. And so sometimes I will hear other reporters parroting some of those things that I've heard to try to smear a victim. And I think it's really important to understand the dynamics that work around these kinds of allegations and to make sure you don't fall into those reporting traps.
There's one other wrinkle in this Antonio Brown case. Even though the New England Patriots dismissed Brown, their owner, Robert Kraft, has two pending charges for misdemeanor counts of soliciting prostitution. And Brown actually called Kraft out for hypocrisy on that front, which you had reported in a tweet that he ended up deleting. Is it relevant here to question the team or the owner and their moral authority in this case? Or are we talking about two different alleged crimes that aren't really comparable?
Brown doesn't have a lot of moral authority left after some of the texts that he sent and these allegations, but I think in this particular instance, he has a point. It's very difficult for a team whose owner is facing those charges to talk about the conduct of a player without a clear double standard. And, you know, the NFL has not yet disciplined Robert Kraft. I think they're waiting to have the case play out in court. I think there are certain things, though, that don't seem to be in dispute, and yet he is still on football fields. He was feting Ty Law for the team's Hall of Fame over the weekend, and, you know, he is out and about. In no way is he, at least from what I've seen, bearing any stigma from these accusations, whereas Brown has had to answer very clearly for them and has, you know, paid with his job.
Is that double standard based on power, owner versus player?
Absolutely. I think you'll see players penalized more heavily when they're found to have violated the code of conduct, whereas issues with coaches are not treated as seriously and don't get the same sort of formal punishment. I think very clearly you could look at some of the allegations that have been made against owners and certainly things that have been found to have happened to owners. When you have power, when you're an owner and you have power, you're in that club in the NFL. Right. And I think this is a case where you can really see that.
Jane McManus is a sports columnist for the New York Daily News and the director of the Marist College Center for Sports Communication. Jane, thanks so much for joining us.
Appreciate it.
There are about 5 million households in rural areas without broadband internet. Only about 2/3 of rural Americans have access to broadband, according to a Pew report. This gap has been called the digital divide. Policymakers have been focused on rural areas when it comes to providing the majority of Americans with access to high-speed internet. But these efforts overlook the fact that there are another 15 million households outside of rural America where people don't have broadband internet access either. And when people don't have internet at home or don't know how to use digital tools, no matter where they are in the country, many turn to their local library. Librarians are on the forefront of understanding our digital divide, and they know it's far more complicated than just having or not having the internet.
The digital divide, like you think of a chasm with people who can't access the internet on one side and people who can and the internet like on the other side. And it's really not so much like that. It's like a chasm with a bridge on it.
That's Lauren Comito, a librarian with the Brooklyn Public Library and editor of the book Tech for All, Moving Beyond the Digital Divide. I spoke with her to learn more about what the digital divide looks like in New York City.
And the more money you have, the better your bridge is. If you don't have a ton of money, you might have a smartphone, which can get you most of the way across the bridge, but not all the way. Like, you have to jump over some spots. If you have enough money to have a computer and broadband access at home, you're good. You're on the other side. You just stroll across this beautiful bridge, and there you are.
I also spoke with Jessamine West. She's a librarian and researcher in one of the country's rural communities, Randolph, Vermont, population 5,000.
Partly what you sometimes need is not just the access, right? Like, we used to think it was access to a computer, but then we got people access to a computer. And then we thought it was computer and broadband. But libraries mostly offer that. And then we would find that people had access to computers and broadband, and they were still struggling. And I think is sometimes you're in a community where nobody kind of knows how to use the technology. You know, it's like we talk about institutionalized poverty, right? Or institutionalized racism. Like, you live in these communities where nobody in your community has the skills that are necessary in order to kind of take it to the next level. What you really need a lot of times is someone to help you. And that person has to be a trusted someone.
That's a role that librarians often play, right? I mean, you're the ones that are then in that place when people are coming in looking for help to try to figure out how to fill out a resume, even to get started.
Yeah.
All the time.
Definitely. And I would say it's actually a job we're really particularly well suited to do. I'll have a lot of older adults come in where their grandchildren have set them up an iPad and then gone back to college or gone home or wherever they would go. And then they need to keep using it. So they come into the library, or they live with their grandchildren, but their grandchildren don't have the patience to slowly walk them through each step.
Or don't understand their specialized concerns, which is, you know, if you're in your 80s and you've got a shaky finger, it's definitely different clicking your way around an iPad than if you're, you know, 8 years old and have like completely perfect manual dexterity, right? Or if your eyesight isn't great. And there's a ton of assistive technology that you can use that can make it so much easier, but you have to know to do that. It's like when I first started teaching people how to use computers, I dealt with a whole bunch of, you know, new language learners in Seattle. And once they figured out the internet was also in Spanish, it was so much easier for them. But you just have to know to get them to that point, which involves understanding their needs.
Jessamine, what about other obstacles that people have to getting online? Like, for example, getting good internet access at home. Does that continue to be a challenge for folks in Vermont?
Huge problem here. I mean, around here, I live kind of in the village, which is the built-up part of Orange County, Vermont. But if you live up in the hills, in most cases, you have satellite as an option, and then you wait for EC Fiber, who's the local fiber internet business. And they're amazing, but it's expensive, actually, to lay down fiber cable. Like, we have jokes about the fact that some of our fiber cable is still laid by, like, a guy and a horse, right, going through. And I'm not lying. Like, that is happening around me where I live, because we have, you know, rivers and mountains and winter. Wow. All of which are very challenging. We have people all the time who, like, they bring their computer to the library so that they can do software updates because they've got bandwidth caps at home with their satellite connection, or they don't have internet at home. Like, try to update your operating system on a DSL line. It'll take days at this point.
Are there people who have smartphones who come to the library and they need to get on an actual computer? And why do they need to actually use that computer? And are these people of all ages and demographics that are trying to make that transition and that go into the library for that?
Yes, all the time. So Well, the first thing about a smartphone is that not every smartphone has the same capabilities. There are a lot of people who are probably still on Android KitKat, on phones that have 8 megabytes of storage. And with that, you're really limited as to what you can do in terms of the things you can do on a phone, like how many apps you can have, how many pictures of your kid you can take, writing an essay on a phone. Kids do it all the time, but it's really difficult. Filling out job applications that only work in Internet Explorer because people never update their websites. The same with government websites, a lot of which have to be filled out in Internet Explorer or they won't work. Smartphones are really small. Even the big ones, it can be difficult to read like a long form article or write a long paper or make sure your resume doesn't have typos because you can't see them because it's very small. Formatting it properly to send out. Like there's a lot of things that you need a real computer to do. Older adults will typically have different needs. You know, like they'll need to contact their grandkids or fill out an application for a property tax exemption. All sorts of stuff that's just difficult on a small screen.
And some of that stuff requires an email address, which you might not necessarily have.
Or if you do have it, you forgot the password because you haven't used it in a long time and you don't have the recovery process set up properly. And so you have to create yet another email address in order to fill out this new application.
Wow. And then
you have to remember the password.
Right.
I've had a couple library patrons where I remembered their password.
Smartphones, generally speaking, are kind of walled gardens of stuff, right? You can only put on them what the company who runs the phone lets you have. And so a lot of these things really encourage people to use the cloud, but people don't totally understand the cloud. They don't know how to sync among different devices. Maybe they have a desktop at home, but there is a whole kind of ecology of how the internet works, what a web address is, what a link is, how a web page works, in addition to understanding how to use your device.
Lauren, what are the primary reasons people are coming in to use the internet at your library? Aside from writing resumes and applying for jobs and government benefits, are there other reasons people are coming in, maybe just to have fun online?
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons why you'd want to access the internet that don't have anything to do with official things. You know, you'd need to send email, personal emails. You know, you can apply for jobs, but you can also watch YouTube videos or watch movies. Or I have a group of kids that comes in and plays Minecraft together on our computers so that they get to have the social experience of playing Minecraft together when they don't really have computers at home to do that with. You know, and watching YouTube and playing Minecraft is just as important an access issue as filling out a job application or an online
form. Why is watching YouTube just as important?
I mean, why shouldn't people who don't have a computer be able to enjoy popular culture? That's important. That makes them part of our society. We have this whole thing on YouTube where my daughter was explaining dank memes to me the other day. And I understand what a dank meme is. She's a little fuzzy on it. But like, that's a common cultural language that we have that if you don't have access to the internet to participate in these more recreational ways, then you don't get to participate in this and understand this other part of our society and our culture.
Yeah, it leaves you, can leave you a bit detached.
Yeah.
What about up in Vermont, Jessamine? Do people come into the library to look up dank memes, or are there other surprising?
I mean, we have the Minecraft kids in the same way. We have like snacks after school because we have a bunch of kids who are living with food insecurity, and so they can come to the library and have something to eat after school, and then take over all the computers and play whatever it is that they're playing. I sometimes make them explain it to me, but I'm always looking for the thing that'll click with people who are not really online. What's going to make the online experience seem like it's for them? And so I had a gentleman in one of my drop-in time classes. All he wanted to do was watch YouTube videos of tractor engines running, which is a thing you can do. I had no idea. But he found the tractor engine community on YouTube, and now he's an internet person. That is a thing he can do and share with other people. And the big thing I think that Lauren sort of alluded to, but we definitely find it even more up here, is access to the internet is your connection to other people in some pretty specific ways, especially up here where we have 6 months of winter. I know there's a lot of people online in various places who are like, Facebook, you know, the panopticon. But around here, in many cases, Facebook is the way you get invited to events. You have people who, in many ways, want to connect with other people. So you get people coming into your library to set up like a dating profile so that they can meet other people. It helps people make human connections. And if you don't know how to use a computer, you miss out. People meet other people on the internet, right? And around here, it's also church and school and dating websites. And that's a thing people really feel more comfortable having a computer to do. And so they show up at our library and ask for help.
And you also teach a class on eBay, is that right?
I have historically. We have an adult education segment of the local tech center. And I've taught in the past eBay classes, because what do you do in the wintertime, right? You sell all the junk out of your barn. And, you know, a lot of times it's just people showing up with like kind of random tennis racket, this, that, and the other. But I did have this one woman. This is like my legacy story about the digital divide. We taught her how to use eBay. She had this like Montblanc pen that she dragged up from some closet. And she was like, this is very valuable. And I'm like, sure it is. Okay, great. But, you know, she learned how to use eBay. Uh-huh. She took some pictures of it. We put it up on eBay and she sold it for $700.
Wow.
Which makes her like a weird local hero, because everybody believes they've got, you know, amazing stuff in their barns. Everybody's got a barn full of junk up here. And helping people, you know, make money solves a very real problem for them.
I'm curious if you guys can talk me through what happens when someone comes in who has no digital literacy whatsoever. I mean, they don't have an email address. They've never really been online. They have a thing that they want to do. Do you sit with them and like start from the beginning and say, okay, HTTP:// like, how do you go about it?
Well, I think the most important thing is usually when that person is coming in, again, in 2019, they're self-talk about this is usually like, I'm such an idiot. I got to do this thing. And so the first thing I'm always like is like, what? Are you kidding? You're the person who runs that sheep farm? You run a sheep farm? All I can do is type. Like, try to explain to the person, like, it's just one set of skills. We're totally going to jump through the hoops that you have to jump through. I'm always like, let's take apart the problem. Let's build it into little pieces. I try to sort of explain to them about how long it's going to take, because I think for a lot of people, they think things are going to be quick because they see, you know, the internet on TV and it looks kind of fun, interesting, and simple. And I'm like, well, it's complex, but it's not hard. That's my line a lot of times. Like, there's a lot of pieces, but none of them are something you can't do. So let's step through it. And again, like with the password thing, I'll have a piece of paper that's like, my email address is blah. My password is blah. My recovery questions are this and this. Yeah. So that when they walk out the door, if they have somebody else help them with it later, because what you don't want is to be the only person who can help them with their thing, that other person has the information that they need in order to help that person.
I used to help with resumes a lot as a job information librarian. And every once in a while, somebody would just say, I can't spell. And they don't mean they can't spell words properly. They mean they can't write and they can't read. And so that person has a completely different set of needs, right? They need adult basic education classes and they need all of this stuff, but they also just need the job that they need to write their resume for. And so our responsibility to that person is slightly different. Like, I would actually write the resume for that person because they need a job or they won't be able to do the adult basic education classes.
Jessamine, what do you think the next few years will bring when it comes to the issues and challenges around the digital divide?
Well, I think we're going to have to take a long, hard look at the fact that as more and more people get at least some kind of access to broadband, right? Like, nowadays in my neighborhood, most people live places where they at least have smartphone access to the internet, though not entirely. There's still places you can live in my town where your phone doesn't work on any network, right? And I think we're going to have to deal with the fact that as more and more people get connected to broadband, we're still finding that people are left behind.
And Lauren, another challenge coming down the pike is that the 2020 census will be the first that will be completed largely online. What is that going to mean for people who don't have internet access at home?
Well, from what I can tell, it's going to mean that they are at the library. We're all across New York State preparing for what's going to happen when the census goes online, making sure that our computers are secure enough, that we have access, that we are training staff to help people fill out those forms, providing access to the computers in multiple languages. We've been watching this for a couple of years, but what it's going to come down to is that people are going to use the library for that because we are the main source of internet access that's free and available to the public in the city.
I've been speaking with Lauren Comito, Neighborhood Library Supervisor at the Leonard Branch of the Brooklyn Public Library and editor of the book Tech for All, Moving Beyond the Digital Divide, as well as Jessamine West, Library and Researcher in Randolph, Vermont. Thank you both so much for joining me, and thanks for all the hard work you do.
Thank you for
having
me.
Thanks so much.
You've got thoughts on this also.
Hey, this is Sarah in Seattle. My elderly father and his spouse do not have internet access at home in Iowa. So this really contributes to their profound social isolation, especially for the one who doesn't drive.
Mary, I'm from Philadelphia. I don't have internet. I'm 75 and I grew up in a whole different age. I find that it's an inconvenience in trying to get information.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina this week on The Takeaway.